This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10, so many of your favourite films.
And let's do it quickly because I really want to get onto the reviews.
Well, I think, you know, when it's slow, it's never my fault.
No, my fault, okay.
At 10, it's Lakeview Terrace.
Return to form from Neil LaBute, and it's good.
9 is Body of Lies.
So Ridley Scott should only make one film every 3 or 4 years.
Number 8, it's...
Question of Sport.
It is, and this is Mark saying, Dear George and Mildred, because I lift share and listening to the podcast in the car is a bit of a conversation killer, I'm a bit behind on the podcast. This, however, is not a bad thing, as by the time I do get to listen, the films are due for imminent release on DVD.
Yeah.
Travelling in alone today, I was listening to Mark's rant about Question of Sport and was agog at his unexpected reaction to High School Musical 3. Anyway, I'd like to wish you both a happy Christmas. However, if you do read this out, I'm going to be listening in February. So anyway, Mark, thanks very much for that.
That's because he'll be enjoying Slumdog Millionaire right now.
Changelings at 7.
I like it very much. I do think that Angelina Jolie is still the front runner for the Best Actress Oscar, despite the outstanding twin nomination, although one is for actress, one is for supporting actress for Kate Winslet at the recent Globes.
Transporter 3 is at 6.
Jason Statham, I am not the gay.
Rab Nabana Dejodi.
They haven't seen it, not press screen, but it's a match made by God is the English Translation. Shah Rukh Khan stars, and if anyone's seen it, please send us a brief but concise review.
Robert Livingston, MA Honours, First Class Drama and Art History at Kirkhill. Mm-hmm. Dear Merry and Pippin, with an evening to kill in Edinburgh, I thought I'd take the good doctor's recommendation and see if Inkheart would be... This is because Inkheart is at number 4.
Yep, good.
I'll go and see if Inkheart would be a good choice for our Screen Machine mobile cinema. I'd recently caught up with Stardust on DVD and was hoping for a similar mix of charm, invention and wit. What a disappointment. A tedious, preposterous story full of holes, a weak script, leaden direction and a talented cast phoning in their performances with a complete lack of conviction. When a ferret gives the best performance in the movie, you've got a problem. And what was going on with Andy Serkis's Mussolini haircut and fascisti thugs?
Well, you know, we are the BBC, therefore we are able to put the alternative point of view. My point of view, however, is you're wrong, and I'm right. I really liked it. I'm going to go and see it again. I mean, I think Insoft is a terrific director. I think it's a very good adaptation of Cornelia Funke's written source, and at the moment it's my standout choice of the Christmas holiday period, but Twilight's coming up.
Right, so hang on, where are we? Four Christmases is at number 3. Very good.
I mean, Vince Vaughn, just say no.
Now, Madagascar 2, Escaped
Africa. You like to move it, as you heard on that trial.
Yep. And?
Well, as I said 100 times before, the lemur is the funniest thing in it. I mean, to Sacha Baron Cohen, it's just like what they did was they went all the bits that worked before, let's just do them again. And this kind of Ice Age 2 thing going, obviously Madagascar 2 is better than Ice Age 2, but it just felt like more of the same for me. That said, I do know lots of kids who really love the first Madagascar. I don't think they'll love this in the same way, but I think they'll find it perfectly passable.
Jerry O'Callaghan in Syracuse, New York, BCL, Dublin, and PhD in political science.
Syracuse? I think it's Syracuse.
Anyway, Dear Sound and the Fury, much as I'm a fan of Dr. Kermode's insights, do think he's missed the point.
With what?
In Madagascar. It's not a film about an unlikely gaggle of quadrupeds discovering their true nature in the world. It's a film about the New York state of mind. Thanks, Billy Joel. Let's face it, true Manhattanites do have a tendency to go to pieces when introduced to the real world. Even when Alex Marty et al. Reach the distant shore, they end up drawing a line in the sand separating the New Jersey group from the New York group. That's hardcore stuff in this part of the world. I'm tempted to mention Woody Allen here, but there are too many risks involved.
Okay, I will defer to your superior knowledge on this because it's because you know you might be right.
The Day the Earth Stood Still is the UK's number
one. You said
one
there's a barrage
movie.
Of correspondence.
Well, there is.
Go
on. How much would you like?
Well, you know, can I just saw you a piece of Keanu's performance?
Dave, listening online from Kildare in Ireland, dear Simon and Mark. That's very traditional. Since Ms. Knightley's wood-related moniker has now been retired, could it perhaps be transferred to Ikeanu?
Okay, that's good. How come we didn't think of that?
To boost his nerd credentials, you could spell it with a small I.
How come we didn't come up with that? Ikeanu, that's very good.
Lyndon and Sarah, dear Neil and Vivian, after listening to last week's review of The Day the Earth Stood Still and some musings of an alternative name for Keanu, I was reminded of a name that was used in Australia around the time that he was branching out from Bill and Ted.
Branching out.
This name was Nananu, said as fast as Keanu.
Nananu.
Wasn't that a hit for Bad Manners?
Nini Nananunu.
That's the one.
That's right.
Jerry in Bangor, Northern Ireland version. Dear Two Doctors, I was disappointed last week when Mark was reviewing Day the Earth Stood Still that the best mocking monarchy could come up with Keanu Reeves was...
Nananunu. But that's not... I mean, I've just been using that for years.
I was convinced that names like Keira Knightley and Nicole Kindling could inspire the name Canoe Reeves.
Canoe
Even when
Reeves.
Said out loud, the word canoe has more range than Canoe Reeves' alleged acting. Davey Watson, BSc honours. Simon and Mark went to see Daily Oster still this afternoon. Feel as though the good doctor may have been a bit harsh on the movie.
No, I wasn't.
On the basis of Keanu's slightly stiff acting.
Slightly stiff.
I love genre movies, but recently have had so many dim-witted examples. I'm almost put off venturing to the cinema to watch them for fear of accidentally walking into another Transformers or Pirates clone. The movie, not without its flaws, does have a pretty good go at discussing the issue of the movie.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, it really doesn't. If you think, if you want to see a movie that does do that, watch the Robert Wise original, which, as I've said before, also has the dueling theremins, which is a reason alone to get it out. And the most depressing thing about this is, when you first hear about it, they've updated Day the Earth Stood Still. This time, it's not to do with men blowing each other up. It's to do with men destroying the planet. Oh, great. That's an interesting idea. Then 5 minutes in, you go, no, actually, that's not an interesting idea. This is the Al Gore comes down from outer space speech, and it's really boring.
Matt Cannon, BSc Forensic Chemistry, is an interesting point. Hello, John. George and Andrew, could you please ask the good doctor why in The Earth Stood Still the swarm of bees take a second to go through a stadium whilst it takes them minutes to go through glass?
Yeah.
And what happens to the planes in the air at the end?
Yeah, the reason is, didn't think it out, all rubbish. Incidentally, on the George and Andrew, what's the connection between Andrew Ridgeley and Eric Clapton? Neither of them have ever played guitar on a Wham record. Thank you very much. You've been a lovely audience. Don't forget to tip your waitress.
So, okay, that's the box office top 10. The email's to mail@bbc.co.uk. Another episode of the Cracker Game later. However, tell us something that's new. Good
Twilight.
Doctor.
Twilight. Because I saw it this morning. You saw it a while ago. And there was a review.
I went
of,
to the premiere, in fact.
You did. Okay, well, you can tell me all your premiere stories. Just for those who don't know, the background, the hard work I can do, and then you can join in with the fluff, okay? Teen vampire sensation from a novel. First of a series of novels by Stephanie Meyer, directed by Catherine Hardwicke, of whom more later. The story is basically a young girl, awkward emo type, comes to a new area for reasons that are to do with parental problems, and she meets the in-crowd and the out-crowd. And the out-crowd is this sort of very Spandau Ballet, Ultravox-looking lot of people who obviously listen to too many Cure records and keep themselves very much themselves.
A bit of Flock of Seagulls, I was thinking.
Oh, there is a bit of Flock of Seagulls, isn't there? They all appear to be sort of experimenting with peroxide, although nobody ever says that they dye their hair, but they look a bit weird. And one of them, who's a little bit of a loner, who's the heartthrob, who is Edward, played by Robert Pattinson, who I hear is now...
Cedric Diggory.
Yeah. He was Cedric Diggory, but I don't remember him being as dishy as Cedric Diggory. Because he's basically, the first time the camera looks at him, the camera almost falls over. It's like the tripod almost goes, blimey, look at him.
He's so gorgeous.
He's just so fabulous, I can hardly hold myself together. Anyway, turns out that he's mysterious and strange and weird for a number of reasons. And does everybody know?
It's a vampire movie.
It's a vampire movie.
It's not a mystery.
So he seems mysterious and strange and weird, even when on not one but two occasions he saves our young emo-style heroine from danger. Here's a clip.
You know, your mood swings are kind of giving me a whiplash.
I only said it'd be better if we weren't friends, not that I didn't want to be.
What does that mean?
It means if you were smart, you'd stay away from me.
Okay, well, let's say for argument's sake that I'm not smart. Would you tell me the truth?
No, probably not. I'd rather hear your theories.
I have considered radioactive spiders and kryptonite.
It's all superhero stuff, right? What if I'm not the hero? What if I'm the bad guy?
You're not. I can see what you're trying to put off. But I can see that it's just to keep people away from you. It's a mask.
No, it's not a mask. It's so much more than that. Now, look, here's the stuff you need to know. I mean, it's not giving anything away. I think we've already said that obviously there is vampirism involved in this, and you can probably do the maths on it. This has been called a sort of post-Buffy teen pick, but it does seem to me to be a lot more than that, because essentially what it is about is, you know, the girl falls in love with the bloke who, as I said, when he's first introduced, the camera is just tremoring with delight at his strange enigma. She's completely sort of besotted by him. He's strange and dangerous and weird. And, of course, it turns out the reason he's strange and dangerous and weird is that he has a whole other life going on. But he is completely infatuated with her. And yet he cannot fulfill his love for her, because he will be overcome by a sort of desire to devour her, because in the end, that's what his type do, or do they? So it harks back to the classic basis of what you remember Gothic novels. They used to be called Gothic romances. I mean, that's why Jane Austen ended up parodying, and they are all about sort of repressed emotion. They're about the burgeoning power of devotion and love and lust to some extent, but doing so in a very discreet and sort of bound up way. So the things that it reminded me of, there's clear echoes in the flashback scenes of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, which makes a whole big thing about Dracul losing his love. I love doing that. I'll do it again. Dracul losing his love at the beginning of the film, and then finding her again.
How was he?
Dracul. I am Dracul. And then there's a bit when Keanu Reeves, right, plays the English guy. He goes, yeah, no, really. No, it's really terrible being English. And, I think I'm going to lose all my blood. Anyway, but Dracul loses his love at the beginning of the film, and then declares war on God, and then has to find her again in the shape of Winona Ryder, who at that point wasn't involved in any shoplifting, so she was just a sort of wonderful woman. But so it takes it back to that idea of the lost love. It also reminded me very much of the more adult movie Near Dark, the Catherine Bigelow vampire movie, which incidentally was, as you know, the first date me and Linda ever went on, so it has a particular place in my heart.
Is that Prof Kermode?
No, don't, Prof Williams, so please don't ever say that, okay?
Would she never talk to me again?
No, she won't.
Is that her indoors?
Can we not do this now? Okay. Because it's Christmas.
Watching a Red Out film.
Yes, thank you. No, but it, all those, because that's, at the centre of that is a sort of, a love story about somebody who's from one world, somebody who's from another world, and them sort of finding each other. So that all those things are going on. Now, it'd be very, very easy to sneer at this, because it's a huge teen sensation. There's a review by Roger Ebert, the American critic, and he said, when I read the review, I did laugh out loud. He said, it will go down an absolute storm with its target audience of 16-year-old girls and their grandmothers. So that was it. That was basically the entire appeal of the movie, was 16-year-old girls and their grandmothers. But in fact, it's a 12-certificate movie, and I thought that it did what it did rather well. It's directed by Catherine Hardwicke, who cut her teeth with 13 and then kind of came a cropper with the Nativity story. And it's interesting that she does dark very well, but she's not very good at doing light. I mean, in the Nativity story, there's that kind of terrible chocolate box thing when the finger of light points down from the heavens into the barn, and there's the radiant, and the ass and the oxen are all looing all around, and it's all very, very kind of, move on to the next thing. But in this, what she does is she effectively does a teen movie that has this vampire motif going on in it. But the vampire motif is obviously, you can read this as much as you want. It's all about, to some extent, it's a movie about celibacy. I mean, it's a very, very celibately lusty film, because as you pointed out, there is only...
There's one kiss. It is very passionate, it is very erotic, but there's just the one...
It's not erotic.
Well...
No, I think it is. No, it's not. I think it's angsty. I think it's absolutely angsty.
I think it's angstily erotic.
No, it's an interesting comparison.
Erotic angst.
That's a David Cronenberg movie. Interesting comparison with Kronos, the film by Guillermo del Toro. When Guillermo del Toro made Kronos, he said he specifically set out to make a vampire movie that wasn't about sex. Okay, he said that was his central idea, was that it had nothing to do with lust. It was to do with a craving and a need and a sort of despair, but it was nothing to do with lust. And he said the reason he did that was, as far as he was concerned, the whole vampire tradition was so much about kind of repressed eroticism that he was trying to get away from it. I thought the interesting thing about this is that's the obvious thing to say, what you just said, well done. If you were on QI, you'd get a honk. Actually, it's not. That's the obvious answer in general ignorance, but it's the wrong answer. What it's actually about is about teenage angst. It's clearly about it's about people listening to emo records and worrying about whether The Cure are going to play a gig in their hometown in the near future, and the lovely sort of details, like every time anyone wants to know anything, they just Google it, and they're on the internet the whole time, they're texting each other, but it doesn't seem to be crass and silly. I mean, I was really quite enchanted by it. You liked it, right?
Yeah,
tell me you liked it.
Well, I did. I have to tell you, I have to prefix this by saying I have a daughter right in the middle of the target audience of the and you have to understand, this is huge. It is an obsession which you cannot possibly understand.
An obsession.
Everybody, if you're 15 and you're female, you are talking about this film. You have read all the books, or you're working your way through these books. We went to see it when we came out the tube in London, right in the middle of London. We could hear the screams for the aforementioned Edward, played by...
to do it as well.
Robert Pattinson.
See, because you and I are old men, so we don't know. His name doesn't trip off our tongues.
And then he turned up at the front of the cinema, and there's so much swooning going on. And Kirsten Stewart, who plays Bella, right? The most drippy woman you've ever seen in your life. She stood there biting her nail. I was thinking, it's your first premiere. Everyone has come here. Just stand up straight.
Exactly. Shoulders back. Take applause.
look happy. She looks more miserable in real life than she does in the film. She doesn't smile
You're
once.
You're such a great dad. Honestly. Hey, Taylor, just made this really big hit movie. Well, stand up straight. Look smart. For anyway. Sake, honestly. Have you brushed your hair?
So this prefect was... my daughter says, if any bad words are said about this film, she's never going to talk to me ever again. So this is going very, very well.
Well, can I say, bad words are not going to be said. No. They're not going to
it's
be said.
It's a good film.
It is. It's it does what it does rather well. Not in a kind of, you know, coy, funny, whatever. It does it rather well. It's with Catherine Hardwicke is absolutely the right person to have directed this. And it does have that... That's it. It's absolutely, I think, about angst. And it's... It does, again, the thing which a film like Age of Innocence does, is it's all about the thing not actually happening. It's all about devotion and longing and wanting and needing and desiring, but not actually doing anything. And I thought it did that rather well. One criticism, please spare me the thwacks from your, you know, from the rest of your film. One criticism, the flying and leaping effects weren't great.
There wasn't a lot of flying.
There was quite a lot of flying and
well,
leaping.
The climbing up the trees bit was okay.
Yeah, the climbing up the trees, flying and leaping, the wire work was a little poor, and the some of the CGI jumping reminded me, and not in a good way, of Jack Nicholson's trampolining in Wolf. Do you remember that? Jack Nicholson turns into a werewolf, and the way he demonstrates it is by trampolining his way through the backyard. Remember that? Boing, boing. Look, he's 75, but he's going like Skippy the Kangaroo.
Just out of the news, just time for a quick one of our cracker games. Oh, look, it's look who it is on the front of this cracker. Oh, puts glasses on.
I can't see who
it's
it?
Jason Isaacs.
Oh, it's Jason Isaaks. I'm sorry. Okay.
As Mr. Malfoy from the Potter films. Matt, I'll pull it with Justin. Sorry. I've won that one.
Well done.
Okay, so this is, if you just join us, this is a festive game, it being our last one until Christmas Day. And Mark, whatever comes out of the cracker, Mark has to come up with a movie in which this was used as a prop.
What on earth is that?
It's a 3-inch ruler with an assortment of...
I've got it already. Yeah. Time Bandits, because there's a scene in it which has Napoleon, who is a 3-inch ruler.
Uh-oh.
Thank you very much.
And good night.
There we are. Oh, very come good. On, come on.
It's a much-loved game.
Thank you.
Jamie and Lester, Happy PhD, Christmas. Pending 2010. Dear man in dinner suit and man in dog costume during the climax of The Shining. During the week, a promising start, whilst listening to your...
I don't think it's a dog, it's a pig's head, isn't it?
Whilst listening to your casted pod in the bath, my iPlayer had a malfunction fit a la HAL 9000. Instead of casting me out of the house and cutting my lifeline, it instead got stuck in a rut, repeating a one-second portion of the podcast.
Oh dear.
It was a bit like when Dr. Mark described Keanu Reeves' performance in The Day the Script Editor Stood Still, like he was, quote, proverbially slapped in the face with a wet fish. The loop repeated for about 5 minutes before madness started setting in, and I was forced to leave my warm, bubbly bath in a fit of rage to stop the madness. I feel that this incident eclipses all recent controversies at the BBC. I will never listen to this show in the bath ever again, something I imagine you are grateful for.
Mm. Not sure that we want to be sharing our thoughts with people in the bath, but if you are listening in the bath, happy bath.
That was rubbish, that was. I mean, happy bath? Is that the best that you can offer? See if you can do better with this. John in Manchester, I need relationship advice from the good doctor.
Yep.
I've started seeing a girl. She's great, and I love spending time with her. Problem, okay. She talks during our dates at the cinema. She talks, and then in capital letters, during the film.
No.
How can
no,
I bring
no.
this up and get her to stop without being dumbed?
Very simple. You say, shut up! The film is playing. We don't talk in the cinema unless we're sitting in the back row of the film with Bill Forsyth while local heroes playing in pennant.
Yes, so it's a rule apart from...
No, I was wrong. I broke the rule and it was terrible. No, what you do is you very gently but firmly say, here's the thing, I love being with you. It's, you know, our time together is great. If you start talking in the back of the movies, I will have to report you to the front of house staff.
Or just sit in another row.
Yeah, well, I have done that before, but then, you know, I took somebody to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I told you this. This was in one of my early romantic desires. I took somebody to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and halfway through they said, oh, this is horrible, I'm going to leave. And I said, all right. And they said, aren't you coming with me? I said, no, I want to see what happens in the end. That was the end of that.
Well, understandably, I'd have stopped as well, I think. Shang Tsung in Croydon. Dear Joel and Ethan, over the past few weeks, I've been impressed by the good doctor's impressions. Many wouldn't regard them as great, but I think they're absolute genius, Danny Dyer being my favourite.
Oh! You want more?
The American camp voice. Whenever Mark pretends to be a studio executive, he goes into the funniest American camp voice I've ever heard. Whenever I feel down in the dumps, I find myself rewinding the podcast over and over just to cheer myself up. As I'm not feeling particularly great today, could you please get Mark to do either Danny Dyer or the American movie executive? Well, we've kind of had a Danny Dyer. Do you have a...
It's not necessarily meant to be. It's just meant to be an American executive talking like this, saying, look, the thing is, the thing with Twilight, I love Twilight because it's got, you know, it's got your 16-year-olds, fabulous, grandmothers come in, fabulous, missing out on the mother's audience, not so fabulous, but it's okay because the 16-year-olds, the grandmothers would just be fabulous, make everything work fabulously.
Yeah, well, that'll do.
Okay.
What else is new?
Gonzo, the Life and Times of Dr. Hunter Thompson. I'm going to play a long clip from this, but you're going to indulge me because it's Christmas.
Well, I might not. How long is it?
Minute and 10.
That's too long.
Well, you can fade it out if you want, but okay, frankly, it's a documentary about Hunter S. Thompson, and it's a mixture of interviews, new interviews, old archive footage, very well-researched archive footage, I have to say, and readings from Hunter Thompson's work by Johnny Depp, who, of course, played the Hunter Thompson character in Terry Gilliam's To Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which famously started out as Alex Cox's version of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and then Thompson fell out with Cox, largely over what Alex Cox wanted to do with what's one of Thompson's most important passages. Now, there's no sense in attempting to explain the legacy of Hunter Thompson because he was clearly a very, very difficult man, a man of many contradictions, a sort of freedom-loving peacenik who ended up becoming completely obsessed with firearms, a man who thought that Nixon was the devil and yet, when he got into the back of a car with him, had an exciting 90 minutes talking about sport, a man who would stand by politicians as long as they weren't popular, but the moment they were, started, you know, bad-mouthing them and being down. I mean, he was clearly a difficult character, famous for going... embedding himself is the phrase used in the documentary with the Hell's Angels, with whom he lived for a while and then fell out with them, discovering that they weren't actually, surprise, surprise, incredibly nice people after all, but some of them were pretty horrible. And they wrote a book called Hell's Angels, which made his name and the creator of what became known as Gonzo journalism. Now, the piece I want to play you is, I did a thing on a while ago for the BBC Radio about my favourite pieces of literature ever. And you were there. You were good enough to turn up and patronise me. And I said one of my favourite passages ever is this passage from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in which Hunter Thompson explains the end of the 60s. And there's this passage which seems to sum up everything about what happened with Altamont and the fact that by the time you got to the 70s, because I'm very much a child of the 70s, all that love and peace and rubbish was all behind us. And we realised, in fact, the world was a pestilential and foul place and the dream had died. Anyway, this is Johnny Depp reading again the same passage. It's not just a clip from the movie. It's another reading of the same passage. You can listen to it. When you get bored with it, you can cut it off. But it's about a minute. But it's a reading from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which my brother bought me when I was very young, had a life-changing effect on me, partly because I was reading. I thought, is it actually legal to say these things out loud?
Is it legal to broadcast them?
Yeah, no, there's things which are not in this thing. Yes, this is very gentle. Not those bits.
It's difficult times.
Difficult times.
It's not controversial, is it?
No, it's not controversial at all.
Has it been checked?
You can fade... No, it's fine. It's fine. Here's Johnny Depp reading from Hans Thompson.
San Francisco in the middle 60s was a very special time and place to be a part of. But no explanation, no mix of words or music or memories can touch that sense of knowing that you were there and alive in that corner of time in the world, whatever it meant. And you may not know why. It was madness in any direction, at any hour. You could strike sparks anywhere. There was a fantastic universal sense that whatever we were doing was right, that we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle.
And I've seen the promised land.
That sense of inevitable victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense. We didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west, and with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark, that place where the wave finally broke and rolled back.
Now tell me that isn't one of the greatest pieces of literature ever written.
Well, it's probably not, no.
Well, I just, there's just nothing else. No, but it is, Simon, it is. I mean, it's not like me to be sentimental, particularly not about somebody like Hunter Thompson, who, you know, clearly one of the things the documentary is very good at is showing that there were many sides to his personality and several of them weren't likable. It's directed by Alex Gibney, who did Taxi to the Dark Side and Enron, the smartest guys in the room. And as I said, actually, funnily enough, so the political stuff, what it reminds you of is the serious stuff he did, like running for mayor. At one point, running for mayor for, I think it was Aspen, Colorado, and he shaved all his hair off in order simply that he could call his opponent a long hair, which I think is quite funny. His writings about Nixon, which are hilarious, if like me, you're a Nixon obsessive, because I did think, you know, that there is something fascinating about the fact that the devil actually walks upon the earth, and there he was. And but there is, in the middle of this, there's the argument that he has about the way in which that scene should or shouldn't appear in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Alex Cox wanted it to be an animated sequence with Hunter Thompson riding this wave. And in the end, in the Gilliam version, it's literally just a scene of him sitting down and writing and looking out of the window. And I think it's beautiful. I think in the middle of all the craziness of his life, there is this thing of beauty. I think the documentary is very good. And I think it's well worth seeing. Bill Paterson is going to go and see it. That's what he said on the way out.
He's going to see it with his son.
He is. And good for him.
And if it's good enough for Bill.
It's good enough for us.
Bill, I like this, and I wonder if... it's Pete, actually. Easter confused. Pete feeling old at 38 in Oldbury, and I wonder if Pete's speaking for a number of people. Twilight, Simon, is the thing I have been fearing for some time, a youth phenomena that I know nothing about
and don't
understand. All of a sudden, remember that stuff? You know.
Well, listen, all you need to know is, I knew nothing about it and didn't understand it until 10 past 10 this morning when I saw it, and by 10 past 12, you knew everything you needed to know. You don't need to be up to speed with it, because the joy of it is it does the work itself. I mean, were you familiar with all the stuff? You were off with the novels and everything before.
Well, I knew about the novels.
But you hadn't read them.
Stephanie Mayer had come in on the program and with the fourth book. When we just a few weeks, a couple of months ago, yeah. And we were discussing then about what a huge phenomenon. And our book critics were kind of, don't think we'll get it over here. Won't be quite as big. And the thing is, they don't read it as a 15-year-old girl reads it, and it is absolutely huge. And yes, Pete, it probably has passed you by. Go see it.
Go see it, and you'll just, it'll work, because it just works. It's a well put together movie that works.
Raj, this is a very good one for in NW1. Dear Banjo and Kazooie, I'm currently looking out of the staff room window at Marylebone Station at a film crew shooting a Danny Dyer movie. If I catch a glimpse of Mr. Dyer before my tea break ends, should I throw my shoes at him? Raj, it's the text of the week. Thank you. Mark in Nottingham, 7 GCSEs and 3 A-levels. Dear Stop It and Tidy Up, I'm watching for the first time on this here live stream streaming streamer thingy on the interweb, disappointed to find that the good doctor, whom I hoped would be the very model of nuisance and irritants when the fake doctor is doing some linkage stuff, just sits there and messes with his glasses. Disappointingly professional attitude to broadcasting.
I've been called a lot of things, but disappointingly professional is not one of them.
Anna says, Dear Vincent Howard, why have I never watched the live feed before? I didn't realise it was directed with different cameras and stuff. I expect BAFTAs to be thrown at you in the new year.
Or shoes.
Richard in Oxford, Dear Dorothy and Toto, I claim the prize in the recent competition for the most relaxed way to listen to your podcast. Yeah. It's the only way I can fall asleep at night. I've listened to every episode, especially the first half, but sadly hardly ever until the end, since it has the most fantastic, soporific effect on me, especially when the ranting ramps up a gear. I seem to fall more deeply asleep. I often wanted to join in the email discussions. It's the first time I've listened live and I'm still awake. Anyway, thanks for the great reviews. My kids and partner have now accepted that we can only watch a movie if Mark likes it.
Okay, good.
So what can you offer then that you might like?
Well, I'm going to do two things very quickly, okay? So Tale of Despero, which is this visually ambitious, but I have to say narratively rather muddled Digimation. And this story, there's a mouse who doesn't want to be a mouse because he doesn't understand how to be timid, and so he's brave, which means he gets thrown out of mouse world and down into the pit, where he meets a rat who accidentally fell in the soup and therefore caused the queen to fall over, and therefore rats all got banned from. And it's voiced by Matthew Broderick and what's his name, Dustin Hoffman. And here's the thing with Tale of Despero, it's perfectly fine. Actually, visually, it's very interesting. They've done a really good job with the visuals, and I can say, you know, well, thumbs up for the visual design. I thought narratively it was all over the place, and I think the fact that there are things in it, you know, rodents, soup, you go, Ratatouille. Unfortunately, I mean, clearly the whole thing will have been a long time in the making, so it's probably a completely unfortunate coincidence, but it did feel sort of less than classic, I have to say. Although, having said that, I do think from a visual point of view, it is easy on the eye and very visually arresting and inventive. It's just a shame that the narrative really didn't cut it for me at all. And
no, before you get on to Australia, because you'll just fill the remaining space with whittering about Baz Luhrmann and Australia, Nicole Kindling and huge action. So just need to do this because it's about Twilight, because this will all be redundant by the time we get to next year, as opposed to Australia.
Well, all of it.
Be fine. Dear Edward and Jasper, I have the books. It's about Twilight. I have the books, T-shirts and CD. Can't wait for the film. I'm taking three friends with me and we're going to go crazy. My dad is taking me and seems perplexed by the excitement. Oh, well, it's signed a really excited 15-year-old, education pending.
Excellent.
This is from Jack in Sussex. To any listeners despairing about a youth phenomenon about which they've heard of, or they haven't heard of, don't know anything about, don't worry. I'm 19. I haven't got a clue about Twilight. My mother, strangely, has read all the books and loves them. I'm now experiencing a strange inverted relationship where I, the reluctant son, am being urged to take my enthusiastic mother to see a film. Perhaps this is her revenge. Now that is something to be terrified of. Liz in South Queensferry. I'm a 36-year-old mother of two. I've just reread read the first two books in the Twilight series. I know I'm not target audience, as I did find Bella a drippy, whiny teenager. But I enjoyed the stories. The books are entertaining for all. Dear Bella and Edward, this is Anne in Norfolk. My 16-year-old daughter and friends have been waiting with bated breath for the good doctor's review of Twilight. All are delighted with his approval.
Oh, good.
As now the ritual lynching will not be necessary, nor interrupt the viewings that they have booked for the next three consecutive days.
Excellent. David, that's the way to do it.
LOL. David in Glasgow. Dear Wallace and Gromit, my sister is bouncing around in the next room with two of her cronies, getting very excited about a Twilight screening. They've made T-shirts with various messages on them. I wish them well as they go into town in the rain. It's a Twilight phenomenon,
that's
and it's
good.
Happening tonight.
Fantastic.
If you can wait until Boxing Day, you'll get to see
the
Titanic with kangaroos.
Have we got time for a clip?
Well, is it longer than...
No, it's a show. You can fade a bit about it. Here is huge action and Nicole Kindling in Baz Luhrmann's What All of It.
Trusting man. Typical
of my husband. She, Osmond's a pretty good bloke.
Yes, well, he certainly knows how to choose his employees.
Employee?
No wonder the place is bankrupt.
Lady, I'm not an employee.
Really? So you're just driving me all the way out to Faraway Downs as a personal favour to my husband, are you?
No.
Him being such a good bloke and all?
I'm driving out because he promised me a drive of 1,500 head of cattle.
What, to buy?
No, you goose, to drive.
That's a comedy Australian.
Well, the funny thing is, he actually is Australian,
isn't he?
I know,
but he's putting that on.
Okay, here's what I want to say about it. As you know, I mean, the story is Nicole Kindling, she's an English aristocrat. She goes to Australia because her husband has gone over there. He's running a place called Faraway Downs. It's all sort of run down. She needs to go there, divorce him, sort out the thing. And then, when she gets there, something else happens. So she and the drover is like this, right? Have to drove a ton of cattle all the way up to this point, and then it ends up in World War II, bunch of other stuff, all, you know, stuff about stolen generations, blah, blah. So it is one of those kind of everything in the kitchen sink, and it's inspired by all these old movies. It should be called African Queen Gone Walkabout with the Wizard Out of Africa, because it's all those different things together. But in Australia, the main criticism seems to have been that it's a cliched vision of Australia, that it's got kangaroos and didgeridoos and billabongs and diddlybungs and, you know, and Rolf Harris and all the rest of the stuff. And as you know, over here, as I said before, Jermaine Greer complained that it was geographically inaccurate. He said, I know that desert doesn't look anything like that at all. I know all the reviews and I know all the things that we said wrong about it. And I know, clearly, I went out there and interviewed Baz Luhrmann, who was trying to finish the film. And I have to confess, I like Baz Luhrmann very much, although I was aware that they were struggling to finish the film. But here's my take on it. Yes, it's sprawling. Yes, it loses its way. Yes, it looks like it's three edits away from finish. Yes, all those things are true. But you know what? I thought, as with all Luhrmann stuff, there is something quite magical about the fact that he does not know fear. He just takes absolutely everything kangaroos did, throw them all in, and if some of it sticks, you know, some of it's The Wizard of Oz, some of it's all that stuff, I kind of watched it with a sense of, you know, I would rather see a director who wasn't chasing a buck, but a director who was literally running at the wall full on and failing, than to see Michael Bay make a movie that he knows is going to work because everyone gets the Transformers
toys. Enough.
I liked it.
Now, don't forget...
as did Chris Tookie from the Daily Mail.
We're off for a couple
bizarrely.
Of weeks. However, on Christmas Day, Christmas afternoon, 3 o'clock, best of this programme, at 5 o'clock... Mm. 5 o'clock on Christmas afternoon, the movie game, a brand new game, brand new quiz, which Mark and I have known is not bad. It's pretty good.
It's great.
I think
fantastic.
It's particularly
yeah. Particularly the ukulele and bagpipes.
And on Boxing Day, which is a week today, 9 o'clock in the evening, films of the year.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.